It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, running is a sport that you can do with just some shoes and a little bit of time. But what happens when you push yourself to run even more, say 30 or 50 or 100 miles? We'll talk to a Wisconsin ultra runner about her experience. First, it's been 5 months since the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in Wisconsin's landmark redistricting case. And signs suggest it may be several months more before justices issue a ruling. Regardless of the outcome, experts say that makes it likely that a new map won't be in place for the 2018 elections. Sean Johnson reports.
On one morning last October, Wisconsin was at the center of the political universe.
You'll hear argument first this morning in case 16-1161. Gill versus Whitford.
The U.S. Supreme Court was hearing arguments in Wisconsin's landmark redistricting case. At issue is whether the legislative district lines drawn by Wisconsin Republicans in 2011 were so partisan that they violated the constitutional rights of Democrats. The court's conservatives, like Chief Justice John Roberts, sounded skeptical of the statistical evidence.
It may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe a sociological gobbledygook.
But the court's liberals, like Justice Elena Kagan, seemed convinced that the court should act now.
This is not kind of hypothetical, airy-fairy, we guess and then we guess again. I mean, this is pretty scientific by this point.
It was such a big deal that pop culture icon Arnold Schwarzenegger was there to watch the show.
Because we are here today to ask the Supreme Court to fix something that the politicians will never do.
But despite the fanfare, 5 months later, nothing has changed. Wisconsin's case is still sitting at the Supreme Court. And University of California Irvine election law professor Rick Hassan says there are signs that it may be there for a while.
I think as every day goes by without a decision from the Supreme Court in the Gill case, it becomes less and less likely that there would be new maps being used for the 2018 elections.
Part of the reason is that Wisconsin's case now shares the spotlight. Other states have their own high-profile redistricting cases, and the U.S. Supreme Court even scheduled oral arguments for late March in a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit out of Maryland. Edward Foley is an election law professor at Ohio State University.
The U.S. Supreme Court wants to take a look at both cases because it wants to see, hey, do we want to adopt one theory or the other theory or both theories or neither theories? If they're going to figure this out, it just helps them to have more options on their table.
There are key differences in the cases. Wisconsin's challenges an entire state legislative map. Maryland's a single congressional district. Loyola Law School professor Justin Levitt says it could also be significant that in Wisconsin, Republicans did the gerrymandering. In Maryland, it was Democrats.
It provides a little bit of assurance for the public that when the court is making these rules, it's not doing so because of its own partisan preferences. If the court hands down a decision addressing a Republican gerrymander at the same time that it hands down a decision addressing a Democratic gerrymander.
Experts say these are not easy calls. The Supreme Court has never struck down a redistricting plan for being too partisan. Wisconsin Solicitor General Misha Saitlin, who defended Wisconsin's map in court, says now is not the time to start.
Politics permeates the decisions that legislatures make, and so courts getting involved in that area would be quite extraordinary and quite disruptive.
Given the rest of its calendar, the court may not rule on Wisconsin's map until late June. Ruth Greenwood is one of the lawyers who challenged Wisconsin's map. She says the June decision still allows plenty of time to draw fairer district lines for this November's election.
Justice delayed is justice denied. You know, all of our plaintiffs and all of the voters of Wisconsin have had too many elections with unconstitutional plans. We have to change it.
But on this point, experts not connected to Wisconsin's case say that's unlikely. Even if plaintiffs prevail, they say new district lines likely won't be drawn until the 2020 election cycle. That would mean that the legislative districts Republicans drew in 2011 will have stood for nearly a decade. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sean joins us now to talk more about the local and national implications of this case. He's our Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So Democrats probably hopeful that new maps would be drawn by this fall's election. Probably not going to happen.
At least the experts I talked to were pretty unanimous on this, you know, and they all kind of couch this in terms of, well, it's the court. The court could do whatever it wants to do. It's the United States Supreme Court. However, nobody that I talked to said they thought that new maps were going to happen in 2018. And so, you know, at least as far as they read this case, because of other steps that the court has now taken involving cases from other states. It's just not going to happen in any of these states that you're going to see a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit lead to new district lines in this election.
Let's talk about the process of drawing these maps. The legislature gets to do it. A lot of times in Wisconsin's history, that 10-year election happens to fall. There's divided government, so they have to negotiate or go to the courts or something. This time, Republicans controlled it all.
They did. So after the census is when this happens, because you have the latest up-to-date population information. And, you know, goal number one in theory is to have districts that are equal in population. And a lot of times this falls to courts because the legislature is divided, or, you know, the legislature is a different party from the governor. And so a lot of states, that's just how this gets resolved. But in Wisconsin, Republicans controlled everything in 2011, as they did in a number of states after the 2010 Republican wave election. And so Republicans got to draw a map that they liked in 2011. And that's been the subject of this lawsuit. It contends that it was so partisan that it violated the constitutional rights of Democratic voters in the process.
And that's one of the key points of contention in this case, right? How do we measure, in quotes, too partisan?
Yeah, where is that bright line is what the Supreme Court is kind of looking for. So in the past, this issue has been raised where somebody has said that, you know, the other party drew a map that took away the rights of the other party's voters because, you know, it's so partisan. And the court has come back and said, you know, it's mostly through Justice Kennedy, who's written on this, this is a serious problem, but how do we know when is, you know, too much? Now, how do we draw that line? And so this is really the latest attempt in Wisconsin and in other states to try to get Kennedy on board with saying, yes, now is the time that the courts need to step into this, because the next round of redistricting is only going to get more severe in terms of the gerrymanders that you're going to see.
That's Justice Anthony Kennedy, also known as the swing vote on many issues. And he was the one in the past has kind of put out this call, right, saying, yeah, I get the sense that it can be. It is possible for a map to have so much partisan bias that it would be like a racially biased map and subject to court review. Somebody's got to go out and figure out something that convinces me. How do we measure that?
And I think you would say that the case that Democrats brought in Wisconsin challenging these maps was geared completely toward Justice Anthony Kennedy, because they kind of knew where the justices who were nominated by Democratic presidents stood on the court, that those who have weighed in on this before are in favor of the court stepping in. They kind of knew where the conservative justices stood on this. That was kind of reinforced by oral arguments. You saw that 4-4 split. And then there's Justice Anthony Kennedy in the middle. And it was in 2004. He wrote, he was clearly troubled by partisan gerrymandering as a serious problem for democracy. But he was not ready to jump into it and say the courts need to decide when somebody's gone too far. Justice Anthony Kennedy could retire, you know, any year now. There's rumors all the time. And so this may be kind of the last shot for people who want the court to draw that line to get Kennedy on board.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about gerrymandering and redistricting, a Wisconsin case in the U.S. Supreme Court. Suppose the Supreme Court comes back and says, yep, we agree with the plaintiffs here. This is a partisan biased map. We want it redrawn. Do we have any idea what that process is? Does that mean it goes back to the legislature? Does the Supreme Court get to say who has the say?
Yeah, the Supreme Court would get to say who has the say, but it could be pretty messy. If you just look at what's happening, it's not exactly the same situation, but what's happening in Pennsylvania, for example, where a state Supreme Court has ruled a map unconstitutional and gone back and told the legislature to redraw it. And there's just a lot of back and forth there. I mean, you have institutions pushing back against each other. And so it might be that the U.S. Supreme Court would come, they would say to the Wisconsin legislature, draw a new map. For you and I to speculate what the kind of order it would be right now would be kind of difficult, but they could first go to the legislature and say, redraw this in a way that's constitutional. Maybe the legislature would get it right the first time. Maybe they wouldn't. I imagine that would probably be litigated and go into court, federal court, and then that might be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there might be a lot of that going around.
Let me throw in another point of uncertainty. There might be a difference between a map drawn by the legislature as it exists now versus the legislature as it exists after the November elections and January inductions. I mean, maybe, and who knows, maybe partisan control of one of the houses would be changed.
It could be. And, you know, we're talking about the legislature here, and rightfully so, because these are legislative district lines and they originate from the legislature. But a governor has to sign a map, too. And obviously there's an election for governor this year, and Governor Walker wants to be the one there who is signing or vetoing any map, but it could be somebody else. That would also potentially throw a wrench into the plans.
And finally, these new maps, if they have to happen, they're in place for either two elections or one election. And then after 2020, we've got a new census and new maps again.
I know. That's what makes this so important. And, you know, why plaintiffs want this in place for the 2018 elections, because we are going to elect some state senators in 2018 who serve four-year terms, who, regardless of what happens in all this dispute, they will have a part in voting on the next round of redistricting. But really, most of the decisions will be made by people who are elected in 2020. And yeah, that's going to influence who is in control of state government in Wisconsin for the next decade.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's gerrymandering lawsuit and its effect on upcoming elections. First, for a lot of runners and non-runners like me, the golden distance seems to be the marathon, right? 26.2 miles. But there's a big community of runners who go beyond that 26.2. They're called ultra runners. The shorter ultra races are 50 kilometers. That's just over 31 miles. While longer ones can be something on the order of 100 miles, sometimes up or down in hilly terrain. Jonna Perkins is an ultra runner and a farmer from southern Wisconsin. She blogs at theultrafarmer.com. Jonna, welcome to Central Time.
Sure, great to be here.
I imagine ultra running isn't something that somebody just stumbles into, like, oh, I just ran 50 miles, I'm an ultra runner now. How did you get into it?
Well, you know, actually, I do feel like ultra running chose me.
Okay.
My husband was the person who introduced me to it, but when I started running, I never imagined that I would ever be doing an ultra distance race. It wasn't even really on my radar at the time. I just thought, like, it stops at the marathon and there's really nothing beyond that. But I did two marathons after my son was born and I had another baby. And then my husband was like, well, you want to get back into running? Why don't you just go for the 50K, which is just 5 miles beyond the traditional marathon, which is 26.2 miles. So at the time, it really didn't seem like it was that much more of a challenge. And I had a 7-month-old daughter, so I was doing a lot of difficult things in my life at that time. So it didn't seem like it was going to be the hardest thing, and it wasn't.
A lot of people think, okay, 26.2 miles, that's plenty. That's more than enough for me. What is it like running in a race? You've crossed that 26-mile marker, and there's still another, 14 or 64, depending on the race, miles to go yet?
Well, so when I'm in a race, so let's say I'm doing a 50K, which is 31 miles. If you told me, no, actually, you have to go further, you're going to go 50 miles today, I couldn't. So I put out the amount of energy I put out in a particular event, that's all I've got. So in my first ultra, in my first 50K, I remember looking at my GPS watch and saying, oh, wow, I ran 26 miles. I definitely have a lot of steam left and I wasn't done. So I think it's all about how you frame it. So if someone runs a 5K all out, they really can't go much further, but the way they're going to race the 10K is different. So it's all about how you frame it in your own mind.
So pacing. Kind of.
Right. So pacing.
Is that a big part of training? Like, how hard do I need to run for X amount of miles or kilometers?
Yeah. So that's when people train, they get to know their bodies more and they get to understand what it feels like to exert themselves for a given distance. Most of my training is done at a really easy effort, and I'm just going to get easy miles. I do have specific speed workouts that I do where I'm kind of playing around with my personal limits and speed. But for each distance that I race, I kind of break them into brackets. So I would say that the marathon and the 50K, I'm pretty much asking my body to do similar things. And then the 50 mile and the 100K, which is a 62 mile event, I kind of place those in the same effort levels as well. So when I'm setting out on a 50 mile race, I'm going really easy for a good chunk of the race. And then at the end, I take whatever I have left and I put it all out there. But for most of the race, I'm really conserving my energy.
But you're placing pretty well in these races. You're not holding back too much.
Yeah. So if you're going in to win, which I have won a few races, and I podiumed several races as well, you have to take some risks. So there's a lot of risk taking. You're kind of hoping that your stomach is going to hold up, because a lot of this has to do with fueling. So you need to be replacing calories that you're burning, and usually that comes through sugars, and sugar can really upset your stomach. So I've had to drop out of races for injury, and I've had to, you know, take a break in the middle of a race because things are just not going well, but I can usually pull it back together. So there is a lot of risk there. I'm definitely trying to go fast, but not too fast.
Do we have a big ultra running scene here in Wisconsin?
We do. We have a really big ultra running scene. Actually, one of the oldest 50-mile trail races is in Wisconsin. It's called the Ice Age 50, and that is in the middle of May. It's actually on Mother's Day weekend. And so that is a historic race that people come from all over the country to compete in. There's also the USATF 100K championship. It's the Mad City 100K, so it's actually just 10 laps around the Arboretum Loop, and that's coming up in April. And then there's just so many other ultra distance races around the state, and there's a huge group of people that compete in these races.
We're talking to Jonna Perkins. She's a Wisconsin ultra runner and farmer. Now, you have this farm near Blue Mound, right?
That's right.
As I understand farming, it's a busy job. You're busy all the time. How do you find time to farm and train?
So it's a family business. It's owned by my mother and father-in-law, and then their eldest son is my husband, and we're both managers on the farm. So it's not just me doing everything. We all have our own roles. We all have really important roles, but I'm not necessarily there 50 hours a week.
Oh, okay.
But I do, my work can be really strenuous. So what I do during the growing season is I always run in the morning. And that sometimes means getting up at 4 a.m. to get my miles in. But I always go into the day having put all my energy into my run. And then, you know, I'm out working in the sun, or I'm out, you know, I'm in the cold, or whatever condition, you know, it's putting on my body on that given day. At least I have had my run already.
And you're in a beautiful part of the state. You've got Blue Mound State Park. Does that help motivate you to train? It's a more fun place to run, at least a lot of the year, than some other places.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people have this notion that Wisconsin is completely pancake flat, and it's really not true. In our area, Blue Mound State Park, it's the highest point in southern Wisconsin. And I've been told by a cyclist, I don't know if this is a fact, but I've been told by a cyclist that we have the longest sustained climb about a mile from my house. So it goes from Highway K all the way up to the top of Blue Mound State Park. So I can get pretty good vertical training just outside my front door.
When you're running races in Wisconsin or around the country, is there a lot of elevation in these 30-mile, 50-mile races?
Yeah, there is. So here in Wisconsin, there's a race I did this past October called the Hixson 50K, which is in La Crosse. So that goes through the Bluffs. And that race...
Oh, yeah, you can get way up there in the Bluffs.
Yeah, it's just a beautiful course, a lot of technical rocks and roots and beautiful views. And it was a beautiful time of year with the color. But in that particular race, I think I got 4,500 feet of gain, which is pretty good. I've never done a race at altitude, but I have done mountain races in California where I'm climbing 14,000 feet over a 62-mile distance.
Come on.
So it's really important to have the vertical training when you go into those races.
Okay, there are a lot of people out there listening who are in my boat thinking, no way, I could never do that. It's not going to happen. What would you say to somebody like that to maybe encourage them to, if not run that much, try a marathon or a long race?
Sure. Well, all it is a commitment. It's just a really long day is all it is. And so I think the hardest thing about running is getting a base. And that's where most people quit, is they go out and they run 3 miles or 5 miles, and it's just hard. And it's really hard to break through to that comfortable fitness level. Once you're there, you can run easy forever. And then once you're in that easy level, if you want to take it up even further and see how fast you can run far, that's where it gets interesting again. But I think if you go out and you run 3 days a week, if you're just trying 3 miles 3 days a week, and you can just hold on until you break through to that baseline fitness, that's when things get really fun. And as long as you can put your mind in the right place, I think if you are willing to be out there for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, a lot of amazing things can happen.
I understand you were trained in classical ballet, and I think that's you've got a lot of discipline going into that. Did that help you with ultra running?
Well, that is actually what my husband told me when he was saying you could do these ultra distances. I was like, no, but he said you like pain, and I have kind of a. And that's what a lot of runners like, is they like pushing themselves in these rigorous ways and finding meaning and satisfaction in knowing that they can, that you can go through those challenges. So I think there is something in the structure and the discipline and the rigor of ultra running that really gives me a lot of happiness and peace.
So what race or races are you looking forward to right now?
Sure. So my next race is the Ice Age 50 mile, and
that's here in Wisconsin. You're talking
about that. That's here in Wisconsin. Yep, at Kettle Moraine State Park. So I'm building up to that right now, and I'll just be in ultra distance training. It looks pretty much like marathon training, just scaled up a little bit. So I run a nice amount of miles during the weekdays, and then on the weekends I do longer runs.
And are you going to take it on the road around the country again, too?
Yeah. So I also have a race in upstate New York called Cayuga Trails 50 Mile, and that is in July. So I'll be sneaking away from the farm. And then I possibly will be doing another 50 mile in California in the fall. And I'll go back to the Hickson 50K in October as well.
Well, Jonna, good luck in all those races. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Jonna Perkins. She's an ultra runner and a farmer based in southern Wisconsin in the Blue Mounds area. You can find more about her at ultrafarmer.com. First, it's natural for parents to want to help their children. It's what parents do. But it can be easy to go too far, and helping kids turns into managing them, even micromanaging. Our guests now say we should pull back, give kids more control over their lives and their decisions, and they'll be happier, healthier, and better prepared for their adult lives. Bill Stixrud and Ned Johnson are the authors of the new book, The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. Bill is a clinical neuropsychologist who teaches at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Bill, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
And Ned is the founder of Prep Matters, a tutoring and test prep service in Washington, D.C. Ned, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, Bill, let's start with consequences before we get to the tactics. If kids don't have enough control, if they aren't ultimately self-driven, what kind of bad stuff can happen?
Well, I think that there's two things that we focused on in our book, Rob. And one is that a low sense of control, where you feel helpless or passive or overwhelmed, is probably the most stressful thing in the universe. And the last thing that we want for kids is to grow up feeling chronically stressed. It's just bad for their brain. It's bad for the development. It just places them at risk for anxiety and depression as they get older. And secondly, that we know that a high sense of control or sense of autonomy is crucial for the development of motivation. You really don't become self-driven and self-motivated unless you have the experience, at least large times in your life, where I get to decide. I get to practice running my own life.
And Ned, a key to your book and the concept of the self-driven child is that parents do have some control over how much self-control their kids grow up with, right? We have a lot of influence.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, we're not advocating that parents step away entirely from their children, but they really be engaged with them in a way that we describe as being a consultant rather than a manager. There's no one who knows more about or cares more about our kids than do we, but we want to do it in a way that's giving them more and more slack in the road, more and more chances to run their lives, and we want to be authoritative and sharing our wisdom, sharing our advice, but do it in a way that's more collaborative, that's more consultative, rather than being an authoritarian and telling them what to do all the while, because ultimately that's not going to help develop their inner drive, and it will also make it really likely that they kind of just tune us out, which then marginalizes all that love and support we want to give them.
And Bill, these decisions over how much to manage kids versus empowering them, being a consultant for them, this actually starts to show up right in kids' brains as they grow up.
Well, it does, and because brains develop according to how they're used. And so we feel that we want kids to practice making decisions, for example, about stuff that's important to them. And we believe that children, and particularly teenagers, should be making most of the important decisions about their own life, because that will shape a brain that when a decision has to be made is focus is on what do I need, what's important to me, because kids want their life to work. And so we think from a brain point of view, empowering kids makes them less stressed, makes them more motivated, and it makes them better decision makers.
And Ned, you guys write in the book that there are a lot of powerful incentives for parents to do the opposite of what you're talking about. We're worried about our kids' success. We think we got to make sure they're staying on the straight and narrow path, doing all the extracurriculars, all the stuff they need to do. There's a lot of reasons why parents might not embrace this idea, right?
Well, yeah. Again, everything that parents are doing for their kids, they're doing out of love, and so we're not wanting to wag a finger, but we're trying to perhaps broaden the perspective a little bit and think about you're trying to develop your kid to be an autonomous, successful, happy, well balanced, resilient adult, and so part of that, honestly, is that sometimes things can be a little bumpy along the way. I mean, I think if all of us reflect on who we are as people, and some of the things that helped us develop the courage and the grit that we have, a lot of times that was born out of things that were challenging. And I reflect on my adolescence, and it was kind of rocky in places. And I wouldn't necessarily want to relive all that, but I certainly wouldn't want to purge that from my experience and my sense of myself, because some of the things that were struggles for me that I had to handle, maybe with support, but I really had to handle for myself, not having someone else solve it for me. Those are the things that I can reflect back on and have confidence going forward, because I know what I've been able to handle in the past. And our kids deserve that same opportunity to experience things, to own their own successes and their own challenges, because that's really what they need to develop a resilient mind.
We're talking to Ned Johnson and Bill Stixrud. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Self-Driven Child. So, Bill, let's get into the how now. How can parents get into that mindset of being a consultant for their kids and not a manager for their kids?
Well, the first thing that we think about is what maybe the most easy way to get started is the second chapter in our book is called I Love You Too Much to Fight With You About Your Homework. And it's about the idea that you really can't make a kid do his homework. And just having after dinner time be stressful for everybody is just a bad idea for families. One of the most important things for kids is if they feel close to their parents. And fighting about homework is just a bad idea. And so if you say, I love you too much to fight with you about your homework, then you go into consulting mode and you say, I'm willing to do anything I can to help. I'm willing to set up a consulting hours from 6:30 to 7:30 and do everything I can to help, but I'm not willing to act like it's my job or be on you all the time about it, because I'll weaken you, because I'll reinforce the idea that somebody other than you is responsible for this.
And Ned, can you talk about finding opportunities at various ages to say, hey, this is a position where maybe I don't need to make the call, the kid can make the call?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I have a kid who's a sophomore now in high school, and I started really trying to apply this when he was in fifth grade, and I would simply ask him things like, may make a suggestion there, and sometimes he'd say yeah, and sometimes say no, and if he said no, I'd sort of step away if I could, because my experience has been that I've never listened to advice that people, that if someone tried to give me advice that I didn't want, I've never really listened to it, and I've never had an experience of forcing advice or help on people and have them sort of go, gosh, thanks so much for making me do it your way. So, particularly when we have this proving ground of middle school years, when the stakes are a little bit lower, you ask your kid, hey, can I give you a suggestion on that? Or would you like my help? Or would it be all right if I read through this with you? And if they say yeah, well then I'm on their side. And if they say no, well, I don't think we want our kids to feel that we're doing things for them, we're not doing things to them, because it really changes the energy, and then we're working together rather than we see so many kids who resist what's in their own best interest simply because they feel like things are being forced upon them.
Ned, how do we let go? Because very often, I'll speak for myself as a parent, there are two decisions and we feel one is better than the other. How do we step back, even if the kid takes option B?
Well, I've got two teenagers. I hear you, and part of it, I suppose, is taking the long view. Certainly some things that look like disasters in the short term end up being the source of real success long term, and we know that challenges early on often serve as the strength for things later on. But also, you know, if you want to do A and your kid says he wants to do B and you force him to do A rather than do B, the chances, if A doesn't go well, he's going to blame you. And even if A does go well, he's not like to say, thanks, you know, thanks a million, Dad. And in part, you know, particularly when we get to the teenage years, I have parents will say things like, yeah, I, you know, we let him make his own decisions, but this choice is too important. And this is his whole life. You know, this is college, whatever, whatever. And I hear that. But if you can see it, if you can think about it from your kid's perspective, the message that you're really giving is that I trust you to make decisions about your own life, except when they're really important. And when it's something that's really important about you and your life, you're not the expert on you. Someone other than you is the expert on you. And that, I just don't see how that can possibly be an empowering message that leads to the kind of outcomes that we want.
But Bill, you say in your book, you talk about people objecting. Okay, so is this just no limits, hands off, completely parenting? And you say no, there is a difference between letting kids make their own decisions and still setting responsible parental limits. How do we navigate between those two?
So we think that our approach really falls in the tradition of authoritative parenting, where it's not authoritarian in the sense that we're the boss and telling you what to do all the time and telling you what to believe, but we set limits when we have to. We don't let kids do things that we don't think are right, but we treat the kids respectfully. We treat them like they have a brain in their head and they want their life to work, and so if we act like this and we set limits and we make sure that we just don't do things that we feel are not right for our kids, where we're assertive about what we're willing to do and what we aren't willing to do. So it's not anything goes or you're the boss of everything, but this message that you're the expert on you and that I want you to practice making the decisions about your own life, because I don't want to send you off to college with me having made all the decisions about your own life. And it's just a respectful message that helps kids.
We're talking to Bill Stixrud and Ned Johnson right now about their new book, The Self-Driven Child. They say kids today don't often have enough control over their own lives, and it's making them, in many cases, more anxious, maybe even depressed than before. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you struggled with giving your child more control? How has it worked for you and your kid? Do you have questions for our guests about how to make our children more independent, how to find those decisions where they make the call and we like it? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you're a teenager yourself, definitely love to hear from you on this issue, by the way. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Bill Stixrud and Ned Johnson about their new book, The Self-Driven Child. They say parents aren't giving their children enough control over their lives, and we need to find more ways to let them make their own decisions. It'll be better for them in the long run, even if it doesn't feel that way in the moment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this idea of a self-driven child? What's your experience with giving your child control over their own decisions? Too much, you felt like, or not enough? Do you have a question for a guest about how to deploy this idea in your everyday parenting life? Or if you're a teenager, love to hear from you. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bill, do you get a sense that we as parents in American culture are getting worse? We're becoming more and more micromanagers for our kids over time?
Yes. I think that kids are experiencing increasingly lower sense of control over their own lives. And parents, understandably, are trying to manage their kids more, in part because everybody's more anxious and more stressed than we used to be. And one of the ways that, as parents, that we manage our anxiety is trying to manage our kids and trying to control our kids. So, yeah, I do. I think that Ned and I feel that this is a challenging time to be a parent, particularly with all the technological challenges that kids face, and managing that and supervising. And there's a lot of ways in which parents need to be involved in supervising their kids. So, but it's hard to find a balance between protecting kids when you have to protect them and letting them have the experiences that develop a brain that is used to being self-directed.
And Ned, you work with kids, sometimes preparing for college. How do you steer, and this is probably directed at the parents too, I guess, how do you steer parents away from the idea that we need to maximize the use of our time, get the kid to the music lesson, the sport, the extracurricular, the volunteer thing? How do you convince them to back off on that?
Well, you know, one way to think about this is what happens with bodies, right? If you're trying to gain strength or muscle mass or speed, if you go out and run and run and run and run and never take a break, you don't get faster. You'll end up with an injury or you'll end up debilitated. The really rest is the basis of all activity. And so whether we're going to grow with lifting weights, you have a hard workout, you recover. You have a workout, you recover. And the same thing happens with brains. We want kids to work hard, but we don't want it to be at a toxic level. We don't want it to be a chronic level of stress. So we want our kids to work really hard for the things that they are into and then have the chance to, like, go offline and recover and spend fun time with mom and dad or their friends or sports or music or whatever. But the problem is when things are intense all the time, brains, young, developing, vulnerable brains are being bathed in stress hormones that have really bad long-term effects on their mental health and also on their immediate performance. I mean, you know, I'm a high-priced test prep guy, right? You know, I came at this angle really from a performance perspective, watching kids who I knew were really academic, who I knew were bright, who I knew were capable, and then going into the test and either sort of waffling, if not pancaking, and think, well, that was unexpected. And the more I got into this from a performance perspective, the more I found the things that help kids feel more in control, be more well-rested, you know, being able to make these decisions, not feeling like mom and dad are on top of them all the time, but that are simply supporting them, maybe a little bit, you know, from a distance, you know, as part of the crowd or the audience rather than being on top of them all the time. When you see that it helps them, it helps them in every facet, including their academic performance, it makes it a pretty easy philosophy to buy into.
Let's go to our callers now. Joan is with us in Germantown. Joan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having written this book. I'm going to run right out and get it. Absolutely. Downtime is huge. I have an 18-year-old and I have a 21-year-old. So they both had friends that were scheduled so tightly and not even allowed to make decisions in, like, riding their bicycles to a park a block away as fifth graders in a, you know, two or three kids to do that. And we had one instance where a child, we did an overnight at a hotel. He kind of won a little thing, and so he came with our kids. The young man forgot his swimming towel, and he had to go back to the pool area to get his towel. And he was basically melting down. Apparently, he had been so controlled. What if we missed the elevator? Oh. He was so stressed in fourth grade.
Joan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that story. Bill, maybe a little dramatic example there, but a lesson. If kids don't have control, what do they do when they have to make decisions for themselves?
Well, they get used to depending on other people, and they lack competence in their own decision-making. And, yeah, I think that that this is why it's just so important for kids to not be directed all the time and not be over-programmed all the time. And the point that Ned made about this rest between this balance between rest and activity, I mean, that's huge. And that kids who are chronically pushed, chronically stretched, that's not what develops your full potential. That's what develops burnout and overload and depression. What develops full potential is fostering kids, that really encouraging them to work hard at the stuff they love, encouraging them to work hard and rest hard. It's not that chronic stress, that chronic being driven, that gets kids where we want them to go, where they want to go.
Thanks for that call. Going out to Heather with us in Monroe. Heather, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I got a question. I have a son. He's older now, but when he was in high school, he wanted nothing to do with anything except playing video games. How do you deal with something like that?
Heather's not the only one in the world with that question. Ned, you want to tackle that?
Oh, we have a whole chapter in our book about this, and it's a challenge. I mean, I guess you know, one thing is, you know, is it chronic? Is this for years, or is this for a short time? I mean, what I can remember being in sixth grade, and all that I wanted to do, and with all of my friends, was play electronic football. If you can remember, little blips on a screen, and it felt like the most important thing in the world, right? But now, as a 47-year-old father of two, I don't lose a lot of my time playing electronic football, and so these things go in and out. You know, for me, I would, you know, try to be empathetic. My kid right now is playing this game called Fortnite, and it's an online game, and they play with their friends, and what I've tried to do is show interest. Well, tell me about this game, and how does this work, and why do you like to play it? But then we also try to set limits. I mean, if he's taking care of the things that he needs to be taken care of, and that's how he wants to, quote-unquote, waste his time, who am I to say that's, you know, better than I mean, and I understand there are benefits to soccer and sports and all kinds of things, but if that's how he chooses to spend his leisure time rather than reading comic books or some other books, everybody deserves a chance, you know, to sort of waste some time in ways that might be meaningful to them. For me, it's only a problem if it's so much video time that it crowds out things, you know, of sleep, you know, and schoolwork and time with families and time with friends. You know, if it gets to that level, it's a different conversation. But if it's, frankly, teenage boys wasting time blowing up things on screen, you know, for several hours a week, I don't see that as particularly unbalanced.
I want to share an email from Kimberly. Kimberly is a parent of four teens. She says there's a fine line between allowing decision power and allowing teens to get what they want all the time. She says, we have a daughter we're allowing to possibly leave college at the end of this year because she's not happy. We are holding our breath that it's the right choice for her. Bill, ideally, parents are going to have a lot of those holding our breath and hoping they made the right choice situations.
Right. And we want kids to learn from the mistakes. That Ned and I feel that the best message you can give an adolescent and young adult is that I have confidence in your ability to make decisions about your own life and learn from your mistakes. And as Ned said earlier, all of us have experiences in our life that seem like disaster. And yet a year later or 2 years later, things worked out well. I flunked out of graduate school the first time I went, and it was painful, but it was one of the best experiences I could possibly have had because eventually it got me into a different field. It got me from English into psychology, and I'm grateful that I had that experience, and it taught me, too, that I had to pay attention to what was important to me, what I wanted for myself, what made sense to me, and not trying to live up to other people's expectations. So I think that trusting kids and giving them a message, giving them encouraging message that I have confidence that you can figure out your own life. And I'm happy to offer my opinion, although I don't know. I don't know what's right for you, especially for adolescents and young adults. We often don't know what's in their best interest because we don't know who they want to become.
A good place to leave it. Thanks to our guests, Bill Stickrude and Ned Johnson. They are the co-authors of the new book. It's called The Self-Driven Child, The Science and Sense of Giving Your Kids More Control Over Their Lives. Still time for you to share your thoughts. How do you approach parenting? Do you agree with what our guests have been saying about letting kids make decisions? Tweet us over at Central Time WPR. Sometimes a movie comes out and we like it or we don't. End of story. But sometimes a movie comes out and it creates a whole new subculture. 20 years ago today, The Big Lebowski hit the theaters.
Let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
A lot of people are big fans, including producer Dean Knetter, also known as El Dinerino. Dean, hey, you are a big fan of The Big Lebowski.
I love The Big Lebowski. It is a wild mix of film noir and black comedy and a satire of Los Angeles. Weird movie. Really hysterical.
Now, I've seen it, you know, two, maybe three times by my count. You've got me beat.
I'm on a self-imposed break because I saw it so many times, it got to the point where I could just recite the script, and so I'm taking some time off, but I love the film.
But Dean, today is the 20-year anniversary to the day. Don't you want to allow an exception just this one night?
I think I've got some plans for tonight.
All right, Dean, enjoy a White Russian while you're watching.
You betcha.
All right, so this is Central Time. More to come here on the Ideas Network. Look at all the happy creatures dancing on the lawn. Dinosaur controller listening to Buck Owens.